Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia says it will halt firing around the Syrian city of Aleppo for 3 hours each day so humanitarian aid can be delivered to the ravaged city. Russian General Lieutenant Sergei Rutskoy said there will be humanitarian windows established from 10 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon beginning Thursday, when all military action will be halted. It was welcome news by U.S. spokesperson Elizabeth Trudeau.
We would welcome any pause that successfully facilitates delivery of vitally needed humanitarian supplies, but such a ceasefire must be observed by all parties.
The United Nations has called for weekly breaks of 24 to 48 hours for delivery of humanitarian aid and evacuation of civilians. UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien said more than 2 million people in and around Aleppo have no access to running water or electricity. Aleppo is split into government-controlled and rebel-held districts. Zambians go to the polls Thursday to elect a new president and legislature. The presidential front-runners, including incumbent Edgar Lungu of the ruling Patriotic Front and his main rival Hakainde Hichilema of the United Party for National Development. Both are confident of victory. Lee Habasonda is a political analyst at Zambia University.
So the issues are around the economy, the question of the economic turndown, the depreciation of the local currency, the kwacha, the job losses on the mines, as well, I think, as issues of the energy crisis in this country.
Mr. Lungu narrowly won a snap election against Hichilema 18 months ago, a ballot Hichilema said denied him victory because of fraud. If either falls short of a simple majority, there will be a second round. This is VOA News. The top U.S. commander for the coalition fighting Islamic State said Wednesday the jihadist insurgency has suffered severe losses in the two-year coalition effort to reduce its potency in Iraq and Syria, where it surged to large land conquests in 2014. Lieutenant General Sean McFarland told reporters tens of thousands of enemy fighters have been removed from the battlefield.
We estimate that over the past 11 months, we've killed about 25,000 enemy fighters. When you add that to the 20,000 estimated killed prior to our arrival, that's 45,000 enemy taken off the battlefield.
McFarland said that leaves the IS group with an effective fighting force of as few as 15,000. He said both the quality and number of fighters has dwindled, with recent recruits often unwilling to fight and poorly trained. But he said they remain a threat as their presence shrinks in Iraq and Syria and followers resort to high-profile suicide attacks. The U.S. government in its annual report on religious freedom Wednesday focused on the impact of blasphemy and apostasy laws. David Saperstein is the ambassador at large for international religious freedom.
Roughly a quarter of the world's countries have blasphemy laws, and more than one in ten have laws or policies penalizing apostasy. And the existence of these laws has been used by governments in too many cases to intimidate, repress religious minorities. And governments have too often failed to take appropriate steps to prevent societal violence sparked by accusations of blasphemy and apostasy.
He cited problems in Iran, Afghanistan, Mauritania, Pakistan, Sudan, and Saudi Arabia. He also warned many governments have continued to tighten their regulatory grip on religious groups. Pro-government forces in Libya say they've taken control of Islamic State's headquarters in the coastal city of Sirte. Securing the conference center as well as a hospital and university buildings mark the biggest advance so far made by forces loyal to the country's government of national accord. They have been bolstered by U.S. airstrikes. In Nigeria Wednesday, protesters blocked the entrance to a Chevron oil facility in the Niger Delta region, demanding jobs and housing. The protesters from the village of Ugborodo want the company to relocate more of its offices to the region. The Niger Delta has been hit by frequent attacks on oil and gas installations. Militants have demanded a greater share of oil wealth and improved environmental protection. Wednesday is the fifth day of the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. Australia's Kyle Chalmers won the men's 100-meter freestyle gold medal, while Mira Belmonte Garcia captured Spain's first gold with victory in the women's 200-meter butterfly. Kazakhstan's Dmitry Baladin pulled off an upset, taking his country's first gold in the men's 200-meter breaststroke. China's Ding Ning took the women's Olympic table tennis title. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am Peter Clotte in Washington, filling in for James Batty, who is on vacation. Today is Thursday, August 11, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Reverend Susan Matali of the Council of Churches in Zambia talks about Thursday's general election and referendum.
We, as a church, would like to re-emphasize the need for Zambians to be peaceful tomorrow as they cast their votes. People must not die purely because of politics.
Columbia University ecologist Marina Courts describes how human and primate mothers take care of their young.
Because the non-human primates you often find in situations where you have multiple infants in a group at the same time, that the mothers and infant hang around together.
Also today, local elections for South Africa's parties to cooperate in order to govern. And a study in Kenya shows that organic farming produces comparable yields to conventional methods. Political party campaigning officially ended in Zambia Wednesday ahead of Thursday's polls, according to the country's Electoral Commission. It says it is working to guarantee transparent general election and referendum. In the presidential polls, incumbent President Edgar Chagwa Lungu of the Governing Patriotic Front, or PF Party, is expected to face a stiff challenge from the main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema of the opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. Supporters of both the PF and the UPND have expressed confidence in winning in the presidential poll. Reverend Susan Matali is the General Secretary of the Council of Churches in Zambia. She told me that recent violence is disappointing, especially when the country is known in Africa as a peace-loving nation.
We, as a church, would like to re-emphasize the need for Zambians to be peaceful tomorrow as they cast their votes. We want them to cast them in a peaceful manner, so that at the end of the day, we could have a credible election which will not be marred by any violence or any conflict or any backstabbing, as has been the case during the campaign period.
Reverend Matali, the UPND has raised an issue of possible rigging of the election that prompted President Edgar Lungu to demand UPND to present its evidence of possible rigging. Don't you think this could also engender passion and possible violence from opponents and supporters of these two major parties or political leaders?
Yeah, obviously you're correct that it has potential, you know, start some conflict. However, after having said that, you know, it has been generally suspected, you know, it has been perceptions and speculations about elections, you know, I think all the previous elections we've had such. And the problem has been that probably the electoral processes have not been transparent enough for everybody to be satisfied that no rigging is taking place. That's why we as CCMG or Christian Churches Monitoring Group are very, very involved. We have been since September last year in monitoring the process.
Political groups recently pledged, not the first time, not the second time, several times, to call their members to order not to engage in violence. Some Zambians I spoke with are expressing concern that because of the competitive nature of the presidential election, that is why the violence appeared to have raised its ugly head again. And they suspect that tomorrow there could be further violence in that. What is the church's call on these individuals and supporters of these parties to remain calm as the election proceeds?
On the actual voting day, it's always peaceful, and I'm very confident that even tomorrow, as people cast their votes, it's going to be a very peaceful day. However, the concern of many people is when the results now start to come out, either Thursday evening, Friday, and Saturday. That is why we have been appealing to everyone to stay calm. And you're quite right that the church and many stakeholders have tried to interact with the political parties to try and mediate ending of this conflict. Yesterday, the Council of Churches in Zambia issued a pastoral letter to the people of the nation. Today, the Catholics have issued another letter, a statement to the people of Zambia, calling for calm and peace because Zambia is bigger than all of us. People must not die purely because of politics. Politics are smaller than our country. So we are asking each and everyone to take their own responsibility to ensure that peace is achieved during these elections, even after the elections.
Reverend Susan Matale is the General Secretary of the Council of Churches in Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In South Africa, minibus taxis are the scourge of the road. The taxi operators usually drive extremely recklessly, ignoring traffic rules. The country's impoverished masses are forced to use the vehicles because they can't afford more expensive transport. Every year, thousands of people are killed in minibus taxi crashes. From Johannesburg, Darren Taylor explores why the taxi drivers feel compelled to drive so dangerously.
Home sweet home reads the sticker on the minibus taxi's back windscreen as it speeds through a red traffic light in the Johannesburg city centre. At the wheel is Tumi Modiba, a jovial 28-year-old with a sparkling gap-toothed smile. Kill them with success, say the bright red letters on his blue t-shirt. Modiba drives on sidewalks, in bus lanes and on the wrong side of the road. His taxi is packed with 22 people. It's supposed to carry only 16. No one wears a seatbelt. Modiba maintains that minibus taxi drivers have no choice but to disobey traffic laws.
Time. Time is mine, my bro. We always work under pressure, my bro, you understand? It's under pressure, the target for the owner. You need a lot of money as well. I have to go home with something. I'm working with money. I cannot just go home without anything in my pocket. You understand? It's really frustrating, I'm telling you.
Taxi drivers don't get fixed salaries. They work on commission. The more passengers they ferry, the more trips they make, the more money the taxi owners pay them. People give Modiba 14 rands, less than $1, to transport them from northern Johannesburg to the city. To satisfy the owner of the taxi he drives, Modiba must make at least 7,000 rands, about $500 a week.
If I don't make that target, he'll definitely tell me, hey boy, get out of my car, I'll find another driver. That's the pressure as well. So I have to make that money for him to be happy.
If he makes his target, says Modiba, the owner pays him 1,500 rands, less than $100 a week. He, his unemployed wife and two toddler sons must survive on this. Modiba works 6 days a week, sometimes seven. He starts driving at 5 in the morning and usually stops at 8 at night. Modiba argues with another taxi operator about who's first in the queue to load passengers. He says the life of a taxi driver is filled with stress as they battle each other to make their quotas. They're under constant pressure to transport as many passengers as fast as possible so they don't lose their jobs. Because of this, says Modiba, they break all the rules of the road. He talks a lot on his phone while driving. He says he mostly speaks to other taxi drivers, so they're able to protect one another.
Yeah, sometimes when we inform each other about the traffic cops, where they are.
The drivers warn one another about the whereabouts of the police. But, says Modiba, even if the officers stop them for breaking a law, like driving in emergency lanes marked with yellow lines, it's just a minor inconvenience.
Immediately when we use a yellow line, that's where you find the police there. They're standing for us. In order for me not to write me a ticket, I have to pop out the money to give them.
So you have to bribe the police?
Exactly. That's what we do. I have to pop up 150 rand and give that guy, or else we won't survive.
Modiba says all he can do is to hope that his dangerous driving doesn't kill him and others. In the absence of regulation of the taxi industry, the system the drivers work under encourages them to drive dangerously and boosts the country's growing road death toll. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
South Africa's three leading political parties face a dilemma after last week's local general elections. They have spent years ripping into each other, and their ideologies are very different. Now they have to form coalitions in more than two dozen areas where no party won a majority of vote. As Thuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, negotiations will be no easy task.
The elections last week saw opposition parties finally loosen the African National Congress's iron grip on South African politics. In 26 cities, including Johannesburg and Pretoria, the black-dominated ANC, the white-dominated Democratic Alliance, or DA, and the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, failed to win a majority. That means the parties which in the past have battered and bruised each other's image have to find a way to cooperate. So far, that isn't happening. DA leader Moses Maimane says his party needs coalition partners, but the ANC is not part of the options.
We are clear that when we spoke about change, we meant that we wouldn't work with the ANC. I'll only work in any coalition that says, firstly, can we deliver for the people? Is it a non-racial movement? Is it based on the rule of law? Will it create work for the people of that city? Will it ultimately make sure services are better improved and that there'll be no corruption?
EFF leader Julius Malema has also ruled out the ANC.
We are not prepared to speak to the ANC or engage in any form of coalition with the ANC.
The election results would seem to put the EFF in the kingmaker's role in some areas. In Pretoria, for instance, the DA won 43% of the votes, the ANC won 41%, and the EFF took 12%. The EFF's share is enough to give either the DA or the ANC the lead role in a majority coalition. Given the history and the tensions among the parties, independent analyst Pierre Krookamp sees only a couple of workable combinations.
The likeliness of a coalition, for instance, between the DA and the ANC is very, very small. It's possible, but very, very small. It will always be most likely between, say, the ANC and very small parties or the ANC and the EFF.
And Krookamp says, given a choice, the ANC and the DA will not even consider a partnership with the EFF, whose leader, Malema, is known for fiery, controversial speeches.
Both the ANC and the DA will not necessarily consider the EFF to be a reliable partner because they've shown in the past that they could use destructive means of gaining political influence. So both the ANC and the DA will do everything they can to avoid having a coalition with the EFF.
Parties have until August 20 to conclude negotiations or else run minority governments. It's anyone's guess as to how the negotiations will turn out, but one thing is certain. A new kind of politics has just started in South Africa. Thuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. A long-term study in Kenya has shown that organic farming generates comparable yields to conventional methods and also produces more income and health benefits for farmers. Findings from the 10-year study conducted in Thika and Chuka sub-counties in East African nation dispel the widely held belief that organic agriculture needs more space to achieve comparable yields than conventional agriculture. From Chuka, Kenya, Ruben Chiama reports.
The survey, which began in 2007, was carried out by the Swiss-based Research Institute of Organic Agriculture in collaboration with local partners. It involved field trials conducted on two locations in Kenya's Central Islands. The study showed that the yields of organically grown maize are similar to those produced by the high-input systems of commercial large-scale farming. Dr. Noah Adamti is the project's coordinator.
At the end of 6 years, we have seen that comparing the conventional system to that of organic system, yield are similar after the third year onwards in the organic system. Due to the high yield produced from organic, although it is not significantly different from conventional, so we say similar, but due to the high yield over time, this yield was able to offset the higher cost and therefore give similar profit margin to both conventional and organic system.
Organic agriculture tends to have low input costs and hence higher prices on the markets. As a result, incomes for organic farmers start to be higher after 5 years. Researchers say in the sixth year, incomes are 53% higher than the first year. Parallel studies carried out in India and Bolivia on the production of cotton and coffee had similar positive results for organic methods. The primary aims of organic farming are to cultivate the land and raise crops in such a way as to keep the soil alive and in good health by use of organic matter such as crop, animal and farm waste. They are combined with beneficial microbes to release nutrients to crops for increased sustainable production in an eco-friendly, pollution-free environment. But despite the huge benefits, smallholder farmers across Africa have been slow to adopt organic methods. Dr. Anne Muriuki of the Kenya Agricultural and Livestock Research Organization says the ultimate goal is to support the development of policies and strategies that foster the adoption of sustainable land use practices.
The organic sector has been growing very rapidly, but even that rapid is not rapid enough. That is why it's not being felt. There are a number of issues that have caused that delay, and now that we are showing that it can work, and we hope this experiment will continue to its conclusion, and the trend that we have begun to see will actually be strengthened. The other issue we have is that we lack an organic agriculture policy. When there's a policy of government that everything can nest on, then the government can push things in that area. We need an organic policy in place. It's kind of being put together somewhere, but we need to do that even more.
According to the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, at least 80% of Africa's population depends on agriculture as their primary source of livelihood. The sector has also provided employment to some 70% of the people in sub-Saharan Africa. Researchers say organic farming builds on some of the traditional methods used by farmers, and some say is the cheapest and most affordable way for families to improve food production. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Most humans love their mothers, and usually mothers love their kids too and take care of them. But animals and even plants have also evolved their own diverse maternal behaviors over the millennia, all aimed at ensuring that their offspring survive and thrive. VOA's Adam Phillips has more.
Like other primates, a group of mammals that includes monkeys and apes, we human beings spend long periods of time gestating, then caring for our young, usually in groups. Columbia zoology professor Marina Cords, who has spent years observing groups of blue monkeys in the forests of Kenya, is often reminded of them when she sees groups of human mothers and their infants in New York City's Central Park.
Because the non-human primates you often find in situations where you have multiple infants in a group at the same time, that the mothers and infants hang around together. When I see that in the park, it's exactly what I think of. Oh, there's one of those gaggles of mothers and kids hanging around together, sharing the job of watching the kids. Many pairs of eyes watching over those vulnerable youngsters at once might prevent them from being picked on by a predator.
But according to Columbia University ecologist Shahid Naeem, motherhood is at work almost every place in the world, whether that place is wild or tame.
Every single species you see, even if it's just an insect on the ground, or plants, or mushrooms growing in the forest, or the birds that are flying overhead, it's a sign that life on Earth is working.
Naeem says that most animal mothers protect their young in some way.
We've all admired cats picking up their offspring one by one and moving them from a place where they thought is no longer safe. Birds will wander around and pretend like they have a broken wing to try to distract the predator away from the eggs if they see a predator getting close to the eggs. We all know if you encounter a goose that's raising goslings, it's going to be very aggressive to you when it's fairly clear that the goose does not stand a chance of winning in that kind of contest.
Human mothers teach their young, often by joining them in observing and interacting with the external world, then discussing it with them. Other animals do not do this. But Professor Marina Cord says there are other clever ways that mammalian young manage to learn from their mothers, especially if they're carnivores.
There are some cases reported, for example, of large cats bringing dead antelope to their young, and they can sort of pounce on it and kill it even though it's actually dead. So she's providing an opportunity to them in a way.
plants have also developed ingenious maternal strategies for engendering and nurturing the next generation. And how fortunate, says Shahid Naeem, that many of those strategies nurture us, too.
Whether it's rice or wheat or fruits, tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, these are actually the hard work of the mother, which is very often provided lots of nutrients, lots of sort of moisture and water for them. And in many cases, the mother will actually put poisons or toxins into the outer coverings of the fruit to prevent it from being eaten. Now, when the fruit is ready to be eaten, then it becomes edible and we seek them. In that case, the mother is actually trying to encourage us or an animal to eat the fruit so that it will then digest away all of that material, go away from the mother plant, and then deposit the seeds in a nice little pack of manure.
However you look at it, almost all life owes not only its creation, but also its survival to mom. All the more reason we should take the time to contemplate and appreciate mothering in all its forms all year long. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Here is our listener mail for this Thursday, August 11.
The proposed federal government loans to rice farmers in Nigeria is a very welcome development. We therefore urge Mr. President to release the loans as fast as possible because the rice farming season shall soon be over in some part of Nigeria. I am Queen Chonishe from Obanuku in Obudukate Ranch, Cross River, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Before we leave you, let's take a look one more time at some African news headlines. The UN Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator has just returned from a three-day visit to South Sudan. Stephen O'Brien told the press that he met with the displaced and those lacking access to food in Wau and Awel. He said those he had met had fled for their lives and many women and girls have been raped. O'Brien said he discussed the security and humanitarian situation with the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir Mayardit, and other senior government officials. He said he expressed his shock and dismay at the report of violence committed against civilians in recent months, including by members of the armed forces. He said he reiterated the need for humanitarian relief workers to be granted free, safe, and unhindered access to all people in need. He also met with the leadership of the UN mission UNMISS to discuss the challenges facing South Sudan and efforts by the UN to protect civilians. O'Brien noted that since December 2013, over 1.5 million people are displaced in South Sudan, with more than 900,000 have fled to neighboring countries. Over the past month, 70,000 people have crossed the border into Uganda as refugees. Nearly 5 million people in South Sudan are food insecure, and a quarter of a million children are severely malnourished. The UN official thanked the international community for their contribution of over $500 million to the humanitarian response plan. However, he said there's still a gap of more than $700 million, which will increase as civilian needs continue to rise. He urged the humanitarian community to work together to help end the continuing strife in South Sudan. That's it for this Thursday, August 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak crew, producer Nicole Beckford, and Managing Editor William Eagle, I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, wishing you all have a peaceful Thursday. Stay tuned for International Edition next on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from The Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.